Hey, Dan.
What up, guy?
You're into this fintech. What's all this I'm hearing about Current?
You're going to like this, guy. Current is a fintech company that's completely disrupting traditional banking.
Wait a second. Does that mean I don't have to drive to the bank anymore?
Yeah, exactly. I manage an important part of my family's finances from one easy-to-use app.
Well, I got to get this app, but where can I learn more?
It's super easy. Just go to current.com/OK, O-K-A-Y, and download the app. That's current.com/OK.
Current is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group, member FDIC, and Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
Will M&A pick up in 2024? Will this year mark the return of IPOs? Listen to Strategic Alternatives, a podcast from RBC Capital Markets, to get fresh insights on the trends and market forces impacting deal flow across sectors and find out how companies and investors are preparing for potential surge in deal activity and what signals to watch for this year. Listen and subscribe to Strategic Alternatives, the RBC Capital Markets podcast today, wherever you get your podcasts. All right, welcome to OK Computer. I'm Dan Nathan. I am joined by Rick Heitzman. He is the founder and CEO at Firstmark Capital. Rick, welcome back to the pod.
Hey, it's great being back in the pod. A lot of stuff happening, and the world's starting to wake up.
Oh, stop. You're going to give me the green shoot sort of thing. I know you're going to do that.
I won't use it. Now it's the third rail. I can't use it anymore.
No, you can't. But you and I, we got a lot to talk about, some of the what's going on in the IPO markets, with markets making new highs, some really interesting valuation stuff in both public and private markets here. A lot to talk about in AI. Your partner, Matt Turk, dropped his MAD report. That's the machine learning AI.
Easter MAD report.
I know. So that came out. That's his 10th annual. So we're going to have Matt come back on the pod and talk to us about that. We'll put that in the show notes. So check it out here. But stick around. After the conversation that Rick and I have right here, Rick and I also talked to Joanna McFarland. She is the CEO of Hop Skip Drive. This is a company that you invested, what, seed-ish?
Like seed. In the seed. We were the first investors probably 7-8 years ago, and she's done a phenomenal job. We invested when they had no rides, no product, no nothing, just an idea of a phenomenal CEO, very mission-driven, and had a very personal problem of, hey, how do I survive in a world where there's a lot of different pulls on my time, especially around my children? And she created an amazing product that now is powering over 10, 12,000 rides a day.
It's a really interesting story. And like you said, it's mission driven. And again, you kicked off the Funders and Founders series with us, I want to say about a month and a half ago. And it's interesting to see just some of these conversations that I've had with these founders and these investors and how those relationships have evolved over time. And yours is really interesting because I know you are still very actively involved as a board member with this company. And it sounds like they're starting to inflect. So stick around for that conversation there. All right, let's hit it, because you were on CNBC's Fast Money. I think it was the day that Reddit IPO'd.
Yes.
And this is one I thought was really interesting. I mentioned on the pod last week, Casey Newton, who writes The Platformer, he called it a lifetime participation award. This is an 18-year-old company that finally went public. It seems like over the last year or so, they've been getting their financials in order. Some of the spending, just really some of the metrics that would make sense that you'd want to see for a company that is looking like it's growing, that is doing things at the right time. And that's all kind of came together in the last year and a half. I think 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it didn't go public in that period of 2021 because a lot of those metrics weren't really in line.
Correct.
So talk to me about what we've seen in the markets. It's interesting. Went public, big one-day pop. Astera Labs, I think, was also the same day before.
Had in a different part of the market.
Totally different part of the market. And they had huge rips. They both doubled in the days after. It seemed like almost a quarter-end, month-end mark, which was kind of weird. And now they've both gotten slammed in the last few trading days.
Yeah, I think they're still trading up from where they were. And you've seen more volatility in the broader market. I think there were some positive gains there. Reddit's a great story. A great friend of the pod, Alexis Ohanian, founder there, started out of his dorm room at UVA and one of the first crops of YC, and thought about that and built that community. And he's not only a great friend of the pod, but a great entrepreneur and friend. So that company, 18 years later, right? Yeah. Long winding road, had a bunch of ups and downs. There was a lot of questions about hate speech on the platform. There was a lot of questions about, is this advertiser safe? So getting away from what that content is that advertiser safe? If you're a large media holding company or advertising holding company, a WPP or Havas, are you going to put your Citibank ad next to uncertain content? And does Reddit have the tooling to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, moderation was a huge issue, right?
So it's moderation, but it's also, is this ad safe, right? So all the tools that Meta had to build, all the tools that Pinterest had to build, all the tools that all the social platforms had to build to make sure you're not advertising the wrong things against something. And therefore, without those tools, you're not going to make the same amount per user, right? So the key thing that drives some of the key valuation metric is ARPU, right? Average revenue per user. And Pinterest is best in class in that, very safe content, searchable, and therefore high intent on the things you want to see. Whereas kind of a broad-based, hey, I want to talk to you about why the Sixers are going to come back under Joel Embiid to win the championship isn't really that
monetized. Is Joel coming back this week or no?
He's coming back this week. They are going to win the
championship. So Sixers Twitter is going to, Sixers Reddit is going to get hot again.
Sixers
is that
Reddit's
part of it?
It's going to get super hot. It's going to get super hot. Yeah, obviously there's endemic advertisers there. Our friends at DraftKings, our friends at StubHub make sense. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't make sense on the long tail. But I would say not a pristine company, as you're saying, and nor would it be a company that you'd see having a huge pop. What does that tell us about the markets? It probably tells you there's some pent-up demand for IPOs. Yeah. After really being shut down for about two, three years, coming out of this time of volatility, high interest rate rises, and for companies, and we've talked about this a lot, both on OK Computer and as well as some of the other programs, companies have had to deal with going from grow at all costs because capital's free to getting profitable and being efficient. And so companies have done an in-between job. Reddit still is not profitable, although have gotten a lot more efficient and is growing. So they're focusing on all the right metrics. And then there was buy-in. I think there's two levels of buy-in. I think one of the things was a real litmus test for the public markets in, are people wanting to buy IPOs? And this is, you know, not a pristine story. Social media, to a certain extent, is a last generation story. And therefore, folks wanted to participate. That was super interesting. And then there was a little dollop of, is this a meme stock, right?
Yeah.
So are there Redditors no different than some of the other participants in the market who are buying a meme stock as a vote for the company? And I think that pushed it a little bit of the way also.
When you talk about this demand for an IPO, I think a lot of market participants have gotten pretty savvy about this, is like, if you can get allocations, it's a well-known name. They don't even actually have to be making money. In the case that you just mentioned, I think Reddit last year had, what, $800, $900 million in revenue, and they lost maybe 90 or something,
little
like
over
that,
100,
or something like that. And they're getting costs in line, but the user growth is not really moving that much or anything like that. And I got to be honest with you, like, I'm pretty good with the internet, and I've literally never used Reddit, and I never will use Reddit. And so my point is I'm sure it just seems very niche-y to me. And then when I think you sent me this tweet from Dan Primack, and we'll put it in the show notes, that in the last 2 years, okay, since Fidelity rolled their stake in Twitter, okay, at 54.20, at $44 billion, Fidelity has written down the value of that investment by 73%. Think about that. That is 30-some billion dollars that have just gone poof, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Since them, since Jack Dorsey, since a bunch of other large institutional investors. And it just speaks a little bit about
the different— Do you want
to say the E word? No, Elon, just think about all the banks that are on the hook for that debt. There was $13 billion in debt. So I guess my point is, like, Snap is in the shitter.
Yep.
Twitter is obviously in the shitter, but it's in the private markets. So my only point about Reddit, it was new, it was shiny, and they were giving it to you at a price that you better have been able to clear it at a certain level. And so it gapped up $13, 34 to 47.
Yes.
And then it went to 75 in the week later. You know where it is right now, Rick? It's at $46.
Yeah.
So it's on its way back to its IPO
price. Sure if it's going back. I think a lot of the allocation in the IPO went to hedge funds who were trading on that, right? You know, is this going to be a meme-ish stock? Are there participants in the platform who are going to buy it? Is this a retail name that retail's familiar with, and therefore it's going to gap up over a couple of days? And could you take your profits between now and the end of the quarter?
And so let's talk about this a little bit as a VC. Okay, so a lot of companies that are in your portfolios that you advise, like, they've been waiting for the time. They've been waiting for the right market to come back in. The interest rate thing that you mentioned fueled the 2021 sort of thing that we had. The flip side of that was 2023, where we had Fed funds going up. It seemed like every Fed meeting and the like, and so capital wasn't free. The focus on profitability was something that you've been talking about on the pods for years now, actually, like right through 2021. So when I think about it now, what are some of the conversations you're having? Because the NASDAQ's at all-time highs. The Fed seems very confident with the trajectory of the economy, despite the fact that they're not going to be lowering interest rates as fast as, let's say, some market participants would like them to do. But some of the data suggests that, like, the party's back on, that the IPOs, if you had an S1, you know, ready to go a couple years ago, you might want to start dusting it off. But the only question I have for you, and we'll put this list in the show notes here, is when you think about some of the biggest companies heading into the 2022 bear market that were private, okay? SpaceX was obviously one of them. Stripe was another one. Databricks was another one. Epic Games, Fanatics. These are all Canva, all companies that you know really well. But I don't hear anything about these companies as late 2024 or maybe even early 2025 IPO candidates.
You are hearing about them as 2025 candidates. Okay. And some people, everyone's dusting off their S1s.
Yeah.
So no one wanted to be the canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, Instacart, Klaviyo, and Arm, although that's not a real kind of growth IPO that we traditionally consider, were the canaries in the coal mine. They kind of got smoked in September of last year. So everyone's like, maybe the market's not on. And now folks are starting to wade in the waters. I think you're going to see some consumer IPOs. I think you're going to probably see StubHub. You're probably going to see SeatGeek on the ticketing side. Mm-hmm. Amazingly, two very similar companies in a similar market that'll go out. You might see Harry's.com on the broader consumer internet side. And so you'll start to see those come out. But you know, those are not going to be the $50, $100 billion IPOs. Those are going to be, call it 2 to 10. Mm-hmm. And you'll be able to test the market with those. And then assuming things go as planned, right? The economy stays relatively strong. The market stays relatively strong. Interest rates not only not stop rising, but they start falling. Mm-hmm. And there's some reasonable transition around the election. I think those top 10 companies, which will do the massive IPOs, are getting everything dusted off. There's Sarbanes-Oxley in place, and they'll be ready to go a year from now. It'll be the big kind of pent-up IPO pipeline of 25.
All right. So, and then what are you telling your companies if they say to you, hey, listen, Rick, Stripe has stayed private for all these years. They're operating really well. What's the push and pull about companies that want to retool? They want to get this trend right. There's going to be a lot of companies, I'm sure, that have kind of reoriented towards AI, right? And so they want to make that reorientation probably in the private markets. They don't want to have to start telling the story. And I think Reddit's a great example in a way is that it was also, I think it was a double-edged sword. I think it was from Google where they got a $60 million two-year contract, access to their API for training large language models and the like. And that's very high margin sort of stuff, but there's not a long tail to it.
Everybody wants some of that AI pixie dust. Yeah. Reddit's going to do $800 million in revenue and got $20 million from Google. And they talked more about the 20 than they talked about the other 800. Obviously, shows are participating in the AI economy and obviously great margin on that revenue, but maybe a little bit overdone. So everybody's not only reacclimating their business model to show efficiency, so showing both a path to profitability as well as growth. And we've talked about that before. It's not either or, it's both, especially in the public markets. But in addition to that, how do you get close enough to the heat of AI, and hopefully some of that pixie dust will wear off on you. We're seeing that with companies like Astera Labs in the public markets, which ripped after its IPO last week or 2 weeks ago, largely being not really a sexy company, nothing that retail investors would use or buy or do whatever it is, but the fact that it had AI meant it ripped. And we're also seeing the private markets. Mm-hmm. We're seeing things attached to AI are getting valued at almost 2020 or 2021 valuation environment.
Yeah, but it's interesting. The numbers now are so much bigger. Every day I look up and I'll see a different story, whether it be on The Information or The Verge or something like that, about some of the valuation levels here. And there's really not a lot of meaningful revenue. Like when you were looking at the OpenAI, I think they were raising a few months ago, and the revenue run rate that they were on, what was the AR, like $1.5 billion or something like that. So you're doing numbers that is growing really fast, but the multiple on the valuation is growing 5, 10x that. And so the headline that I read this morning was about Scale AI at $13 billion, Amazon coming in for another $2.75 billion, and Anthropic. This is a company that they're not only using their models, but they ultimately want to compete at some point. They're doing other investments. The same thing with Google is investing in Anthropic, big billion-dollar numbers, and they will be also competing with them. So how does this all square from a valuation standpoint where there seems to be a lot of frenemies out there?
So if you're sitting there in an investment partnership saying, hey, we're going to throw in another $1 billion at $13 billion or over 100 times revenue, you're obviously not saying, hey, I'm just going to make a bet of that type based on AI being cool. You have to have some logic behind it. Mm-hmm. So as we look at these things, we're always saying, hey, would we do that knowing what we know? And if obviously we come to a conclusion that's different than that, we say, what are they thinking? Mm-hmm. These aren't stupid people. These are thoughtful investors who have made a lot of great investments. What are they thinking? So the key thing that a lot of these folks are thinking is with the new AI models, there's going to be a new whole AI-powered class of software, and you're going to rethink about every single business model, especially software-based business models. So you think about the legacy ERP guys, and whether that's two generations ago of the IBMs or SAPs or last generations with the HubSpots and Salesforces, are those models going to be rethought about from an AI-first, data-first perspective, and the new giants will emerge on this new platform? So you're making that bet where you say, hey, there are several $100 billion companies to be built, and this is the early days. And now, in the Cambrian era of AI, this is the time you make those bets. Or can you say, hey, there's huge profit pools out there that this is going to be able to chip away at? So you look at the profit pool that Google has on search. Can you chip away at a part of that profit pool by using something different? And even if you're only able to get 10% of Google's search profit pool, is that still a multi-billion dollar company? So those are the two different ways that folks are trying to size the market and probability adjust the outcomes there and creating the underwriting models that you're seeing out there in the market.
We had Ann Bordetsky, who led the Series A in Perplexity. And so that kind of speaks exactly in the CEO of Perplexity, Arvind Srinivas, a few weeks ago on the pod. And it was interesting because the way you just framed it, going after, let's say, you know, the search TAM that Google owns, and a company like Perplexity is clearly doing that. That A round was a year ago. The B round was late last year. Supposedly there's a C round that's being reported on right now. And the valuation keeps doubling, right? Despite the fact that the revenues are probably in the tens of millions. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you think about that. How do these companies, whether it's a Perplexity at a billion, a Scale at 13 billion, and Anthropic at what, 20, or how do they grow into these? Because we started the conversation by talking about smaller IPOs testing the waters.
Well, you got to say you're growing slow then fast, right? Yeah. That they're going to say, yeah, Google grew slow on the revenue side, then very fast.
Yeah.
Same thing with Meta once they turned on monetization. So you have to assume you're going to build a huge consumer footprint or enterprise footprint and then be able to grow in there. And then you're also going to have huge barriers to entry. So are there data network effects that you have proprietary data and can build data network effects around that? Are there large language models that you've built are proprietary to your use case, which are much better than everyone else's? Mm-hmm. People that are making these bets, and we've made several, is that can you prove that you're going to be a winner? And the conventional wisdom is in this last couple of years, next couple of years, the winners are going to be decided of this AI revolution. And if you're not in those companies and those companies aren't incredibly well capitalized, they're not going to be able to take advantage of this seismic shift. And therefore, you better get in and you better make sure those companies are adequately capitalized to take on both the competition from other startups as well as the grounded leaders.
Do you get nervous though? And again, you've been through a bunch of these kind of cycles, the hype cycles, but also the ones that really turned out into being massive, like long tail sort of situations where you read headlines. Here's one from the information this morning: Microsoft and OpenAI plot $100 billion Stargate AI supercomputer. It sounds like they're taking like a page out of Elon's playbook a little bit with all the funny names and the big numbers. And we remember Sam Altman, I think it was about a month or two ago, was talking about how they need to raise trillions of dollars, $7 trillion for all the GPUs.
I think a little bit of that is an air war of saying Sam Altman, a couple other people are the only people who can raise billions and trillions.
Yeah.
They're able to say, unless you could raise $10 billion, don't bother showing up.
Yeah.
So you're getting people out of the game by raising the ante so much that a lot of people can't participate who don't have an access to a Microsoft pocketbook or a Middle Eastern pocketbook.
Yeah. So in these past cycles, Rick, you guys are early stage. You've come on our shows and you talked about how you were like the first check-in and you participated from seed to Series A, B, and then you let some of the other guys get into the goofy valuations once, and then you exit. You know what I mean? Like ultimately, now, obviously, there's strategic M&A as an exit. There's IPO and the like here. So when I think about where we are right now, have some of these strategic partners. NVIDIA is huge in the VC space, right?
Yes.
And so we just mentioned Microsoft, which is funding all these massive platform companies are throwing billions and billions of dollars around. Is it crowding out VC? Is it crowding out price discovery that I think you guys are generally pretty good at? Isn't that kind of the drill? And you guys aren't getting kickbacks from the companies that you're investing in buying your cloud services or buying your GPUs and the like. And so is this different this time?
I think the in-kind investment, it's much more different. So you think about what OpenAI got from Microsoft or GCP is doing certain deals, Azure is doing deals. Obviously, AWS is doing deals. Yeah. So that's a little bit different. And so it's not really hard dollars. And then obviously NVIDIA has a big fund. OpenAI has a big fund. So you always are somewhat wary of corporate VCs and how much of their valuation is based on their strategic need versus being in the hottest companies versus a real valuation method. So you're always wary about corporate VCs, about how much of both the valuation decision, the decision to invest, is being involved in a hot company or getting strategic access or buying the poster for their website. So all those things have less to do with making money for their investors and more to do with other things. So you worry a little bit about that in this part of the cycle. And you're starting to see things that don't wholly make sense from a deal dynamics perspective, whether that's pricing, whether it be structure of the investments, or a bunch of other insanity that you've seen out there. Though I won't repeat to protect the innocent.
Yeah, fair enough. Hey, you just mentioned though some of these kind of incumbents of the last cycle. So some of these ERP or these, yep, you know, CRM. When I think about this, there's a really interesting one out here, and this is Adobe. And we know that they tried to buy this company, Figma, and it's a great company, and it probably would have been a great partnership and the like. But regulatory, like, just shut it down. Right? So they call off that deal. Adobe reported earnings, I want to say a few weeks ago, and they just didn't have enough to talk about as it related to generative AI. Now, we know that the Figma deal had something to do in and around the edges on thinking about just better competing with some upstarts and the like here. But this is a $225 billion market cap company that's down 20% from its recent 52-week highs, more from its all-time highs from 2021. And public market investors are basically saying right now, you don't have what it takes to be mentioned in this, you know, generative AI public markets story. And I just find that really interesting in a way, because we've had new highs in the NASDAQ almost seemingly every day for the last 2 months, and it's starting to get a little more picky and choosy. And another name, this was a darling in 2021, Snowflake, doesn't have the goods. Their CEO just, their legendary CEO just resigned here. So are we starting to see, is this potential bifurcation between the haves and the have-nots, is it going to make it more difficult to bring some of these companies to market if you don't have the story? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You have to be part of, or even if you're a software company today, are you disrupting yourself? And are you going to be part of that next generation? You're going to be able to leverage your capital base and your distribution advantage, similar to a Microsoft, to be reinventing yourself, be part of that next generation? Or are you going to be left behind? And I think Adobe's doing some stuff, especially around advertising and the Firefly project, which is helping them reinvent part of their business. Snowflake is partnering with one of our companies, Dataiku. We had Florian on the pod.
Yeah, we did.
Dataiku was Snowflake's partner of the year to doing some of the generative AI stuff for them and figuring out a way in their ecosystem to take advantage of the emergence of enterprise artificial intelligence. People are trying to get into it, but it's very clear when you look at the earnings calls, there's almost a perfect correlation with stock performance and the amount of times that you mention AI. I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but obviously this is going to be a time over the next 2 years where every corporation is going to need an AI strategy. Not only are they going to need the talking points, but they're going to need to be able to execute. And I think there could be a beginning of consolidation in the back half of this year and next year.
Yeah, another one. I mean, we just mentioned Casey Newton at Platformer. He had an article about the indie AI companies, the private ones, some of them having a very difficult right now time. Some that are basically inflection. We just saw that and how it's just engulfed by Microsoft as a bit of an acqui-hire, but he listed a bunch of other examples. Just before we get out of here, I want to get your take on this. This was an article in the FT, so we're recording this Monday afternoon. You're probably listening to this on Wednesday. But it was, huge AI funding leads to hype and grifting, warns DeepMind's Dennis Hassabis. British AI pioneer says billions of dollars being poured into startups is obscuring scientific progress in the field. I didn't expect to see that. The surge of money flooding into artificial intelligence has reshuffled in some crypto-like hype that is obscuring the incredible scientific progress in the field, according to Dennis Hassabis. So that's interesting to me. And then it goes on to talk about some other things, some similarities to what we saw in crypto and the like here. But again, it seems like as many positive stories there are about valuations, about who's partnering strategically, about all the amazing whiz bang things that are coming out, there's starting to be some sort of focus on, okay, how do we commercialize these products? How do we keep moving forward in the right direction and the like here?
You're making the transition from science projects to business. And that's always the key thing.
Yeah.
And that's where we think it's super important that we like to invest in companies that have products which do jobs. And those jobs have a real ROI for enterprises or for consumers. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these things, again, on the very primordial era of AI that reemerged over the last year or two, have been science projects. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not even science projects. Sometimes scientists in search of a project that are getting mm-hmm. tens or even hundreds of billions of dollars because they're a foremost thinker in the space. So now as these guys are starting to do projects, they're getting away from the science projects and going after doing the real work. Some of the science project guys are mad about that.
Yeah.
They believe in research for the sake of research.
Well, that was a bit of the open AI dust up in the fall. And you're seeing that play out in some other really well-funded people being clear now.
A lot of those folks are being clear saying, hey, it was great when I was in the DeepMind lab. I was in the Meta lab doing research for research sake. But now the economic opportunity is so great. I'm going to go start a company, found it, and see if I could participate in the economic stream going forward. And in order to do that, I have to build a product that people are willing to pay for because it's able to create real value. And that's hopefully the part of the cycle we're at now that a lot of the researchers are saying, hey, this is a real thing. We can create real products that are going to create real value for people and therefore very valuable companies. And that's super exciting to participate in.
You just said something really interesting that a lot of these former academic thinkers who are inside these labs and writing these papers and the like here, they jumped ship because they knew they could go raise hundreds of millions of dollars at a $1 billion valuation and then continue to do that as long as they keep moving towards this narrative of LLMs or multimodal and really speak to it. And they know that these hyperscalers are going to be really interested because if it works, then they're going to want to put those products and services on their cloud and then resell them. And so it's like this kind of virtuous sort of cycle in a way. At some point, the music's going to stop, though. There's going to be something that causes a big slowdown. I suspect it's going to be the lack of commercialization of some of these products in the near term.
Exactly. Or can the researchers deliver product in a timely manner that creates value? That's a big thing. There's very few of these AI products that are getting paid for now.
Yeah.
Especially by the enterprise. I mean, if you say AI is in maybe the second inning, maybe the third inning of your open AI and you have a consumer product that people are using, enterprise AI is, the game hasn't really even started yet. Yeah. There's proof of concepts out there. Obviously, every board of directors of every company in the last year has said, what's our AI strategy? But they're starting to do proofs of concepts. They're starting to do research. They're starting to buy Gartner reports of who should I be talking to? And there's been a lot of tire kicking. And I think we're just starting to see, because you got to remember also, last year's enterprise cycle was way down because you're dealing with the effects of all the market volatility. So budgets were cut in 23, and therefore budgets were down and people were trying to look at proof of concepts. Now, as the market reemerges, budgets are up and the top of that budget prioritization is AI.
Yeah.
So you're going to start to see spend occur. But pretty soon after you're spending that money, you're going to want to see milestones, you're going to want to see proof of performance, you're going to want to see real value being created. And that's what everyone's going to be looking for in the second half of 24 and into 25.
Well, it's funny, talking to Florian from .iq, again, with Matt Turk a few weeks ago, I actually think that opportunity is so much more interesting than consumer AI in the enterprise, because I just think about it, right? Consumers have been very used to just going to Google and searching for free and having to look at ads and this and that or whatever. I just think that enterprise, this is mission critical for them to do this. And I think they're more likely to spend on some of this stuff than consumers are. All right, Rick, we covered a lot of ground here. I just really wanted to get a little vibe check of the IPO market, evaluations in the private markets, how some of it might be spilling over into the public markets and some of these
things. People are feeling better.
Yeah.
People are feeling better than they have in the last couple of years. And you're starting to see some of the beginning points which lead you out of it. So last cycle's IPOs are starting to trade up and perform better. Obviously, NASDAQ at record highs, market at record highs. New issues are trading up almost irrationally.
Yeah.
And therefore, obviously showing fundamental demand. And we're seeing in the private markets, even companies that don't have the AI pixie dust are seeing great valuations if they're the premium company.
Yeah. All right.
All good signs.
All good signs. It could be a sign of the top. I'm just saying, people, I'm not trying to push back by any means here. All right. Stick around for my conversation with Rick and Joanna McFarland, the CEO of Hop, Skip, Drive.
Hey, Hey, listeners, it's Dan here. I want to tell you about a company that I'm really excited about. It's called Current. It's a fintech company that's completely disrupting traditional banking. I'm a new Current customer. It's already helping me and my entire family manage our finances, all from one easy-to-use app. So try Current for yourself and get the app by going to current.com/OK. That's current.com/OK.
Current is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group, member FDIC, and Cross River Bank, member FDIC. In today's hyper-fast markets, it's never been more important to consider every option to raise capital, drive growth, and create value. Stay one step ahead with Strategic Alternatives, a podcast from RBC Capital Markets. In this season, RBC's experts will examine how corporates and investors are evaluating their strategic plans, reassessing their portfolios, and reallocating capital to help them lead today and define tomorrow. Tune in to Strategic Alternatives, the RBC Capital Markets podcast today.
Welcome to OK Computer for our Funders and Founders series. I'm Dan Nathan. I am joined by, many of you guys know, Rick Heitzman. He's the managing partner and founder at First Mark Capital. Rick, welcome.
Welcome. What's going on, man?
You brought one of your founders who I actually am really fascinated by this company, not just because she started herself for her own personal reasons, but it's something as a parent I can really relate to. Joanna McFarland, you are the CEO and co-founder of Hop Skip Drive. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So one of the things we're trying to do with this series is really key on some really interesting companies that are growing really fast. They're mission driven by the founders and really trying to figure out what the secret sauce is between also the investor in the company and what drew them to the founder, to the mission, to the company, and how they really work together over the course of years. You founded this company 10 years ago. Talk to me a little bit about the problem you were looking to solve. It seemed like something that was very personal to you also.
I was living in LA. I am living in LA, and I have two kids. And I was a full-time working mom, and I was feeling really guilty when my son wanted to do karate on Thursday at 3 o'clock, and I had to say no because I had no way of getting him there. And every mom I knew had this problem. I was at a birthday party. Every mom there had a version of the transportation struggle, and it was really impacting these moms, these kids, these families. It was limiting what they could do. And as a joke, I said, we should throw money in a pot and buy a van and hire the stay-at-home moms in the neighborhood to drive our kids around. And all the moms looked at me like, okay, yeah. And my co-founder said, how do we do that? I'm dying. And we started meeting at her house on Sunday mornings. Kids played in the other room, and we mapped this out at her dining room table. I became so obsessed with the idea that I couldn't not start it.
Yeah. So give me a sense of your background. Like, what caused you to propose an idea like that and then really start to not only just find some people that could help you achieve that goal, realizing whether it's possible or not, and then really constructing a company that could attack such a mission. And again, if you think back to 10 years ago, at the time, Uber, Lyft, these were companies that were not public, but they were very popular in the private markets. And so I'm just curious, what in your background led you to get to this point where you're like, you know what, I can do this. I can fix this problem.
I started my career in investment banking. And so I had spent a lot of time in investment banking and private equity, went to business school, and then shifted into technology. So I was doing product management and business development for a number of tech companies. So I knew how to build product. I had just never started it from scratch before. But I had always thought of myself as, when people ask, what do you do? I'm a problem solver. I figure out a different way to get to yes. And so if there is a sticky problem, in my old jobs, people always say, we can't get this done. Let's give it to Joanna. She'll figure it out. And so when I got really excited about the problem, I just became so passionate about solving it that I literally couldn't not do it.
Yeah. And Rick, a lot of our listeners know you have tremendous experience with like consumer facing tech startups. You guys do early stage sort of stuff. So you guys get to meet the founders at these inflection points like really early on, and then you help guide them through that sort of experience.
And sometimes even pre-point.
Yeah.
And when I started talking to Joanna, I understood the problem set. As she said, it was almost the role she was born to play. She had the quantitative side from investment banking and private equity, understood value and value creation. She had the internet and project management side from the second part of her experience and her ability to get things done, which was referenceable. And then she had that deep personal problem, which she understood the consumer need and why this really is a problem that needed to be solved and how big of a problem it was. So you put those together in a Venn diagram, a very small group of people who could uniquely solve the problem. And that was great. So I talked to Joanna. We had a great conversation. I realized my kids, and they have a lot of the same problems. And then I said, you know, all right, Joanna, do you have metrics about how many rides you're doing, what's going on? And she said, no. So how many rides did you do yesterday? Zero. How many rides did you do the day before? Zero. That's why we're raising money. We don't have insurance. We don't have rides. We have basically an idea. And I said, great, we're in.
All right, so no rides. So you're building a tech platform. That's what you started with. Let's talk about that, because Rick just mentioned a couple of things, like the logistics of like coordinating this idea. It's a lot more complicated than some of the rideshare models that some folks had gotten probably pretty used to 10 years ago. What were some of the biggest problems you had to tackle first creating this platform?
Our platform is really interesting because there are a lot of different users, right? You have the parent who is arranging the ride, who is a user, but not experiencing the actual ride experience themselves. You have the driver who is accessing the platform. And the beauty of the platform is this is something that is safe for them. So we call them care drivers because they have to have 5 years of caregiving experience, among a lot of other things. But they are really seeking this platform out as a very safe way for them to earn income in a flexible manner. They're often caregiving for loved ones, kids, grandkids, elderly relatives, and this can fit in their schedule in a way that's pretty unique. And then as we have grown, we have shifted the business to contracting with school districts. So we have school district partners that are our users and people in transportation who are routers who are our users. When people say, who are your customer? I'm like, pick one, because we have a lot of different users. And so we have to think about how that technology hits every single one of them. What is the experience they're having? How does that tie into the whole platform itself? And how do we continue to make that experience better for them?
And what's the business model? Is it like, so you're licensing to, let's say, the schools, but then on the other side, there's a subscription for the actual like riders?
No. So the business model is pretty fascinating. School transportation is the largest mass transit system in our country, and it's big. Schools spend $30 billion a year on transportation. So it's this massive transportation space that not a lot of people know about or talk about, and it's fundamentally broken. It is incredibly inefficient. We have a structural challenge in that there are not enough bus drivers, and there will not be enough bus drivers because it's a hard job that not a lot of people want to do anymore, because you can earn so much more money and work so many more hours driving for Amazon or UPS or anything else once you have that commercial driver's license. So what we do is we help schools supplement the school bus and provide transportation solutions for kids who don't fit neatly on a bus route, who are highly mobile. These tend to be some of our most underprivileged youth. So students who are homeless, students who are in the foster system, students who have special needs. They move around a lot, so it's hard to route them. They don't fit neatly on a school bus route. They're often coming from very far away. So that's where the technology also comes in, routing these students, making sure they have a ride, and making sure, like, if a kid moves at 10:30 at night, we can get them to school the next day. Nobody else can do that.
Trust, safety, these are things.
So trust and safety, that's what I was going to go. And safety in the brand of Hop, Skip, Drive, doing over 10,000 rides a day and have been doing it for years, and the ability to do that with our most vulnerable, right? Children, especially children who are disadvantaged, is incredibly important. So whether that's a brand that you're selling into the school district, whether it's a brand that you're selling into a family, being able to say, I have trusted drivers who have the highest level of certification, verification, and background screening, and I'm tracking them in a much different way than existing rideshare providers, that's become the brand. And as much as the technology to be able to get someone from here to there is great, and I think at the scale we're at is definitely a competitive advantage, also the brand and the know-how baked into that system over a decade makes what the whole experience is incredibly special.
So it's interesting, Joanna, you mentioned that there's this shortage of drivers, and COVID did not help that, right, when schools got shut down and the like. And so when you think about some of the groups that you're basically targeting to assist in getting to school, I read this in doing a little research here, is that you were talking about, like, when some of these vulnerable groups, whether they're homeless, whether they're in foster care, they move around a lot, they skip schools if they're not able to get bused. There's also this component of it where if you can keep them going to the same schools, if there's some sort of continuity about this, is that every time a kid moves school at a certain age, they lose months and months of learning. Talk to me a little bit about that, because again, it's not something I expected to, you know, learn about when I was researching your company. But again, it speaks to the kind of mission that you're trying to create. It's not just getting your kid to karate in a way that makes you feel better about your own commitments, but it's also doing this across a demographic spectrum that I think a lot of folks, including investors, feel pretty good about too.
At the beginning, it was about creating opportunity, and that was opportunity for moms, for families like mine, right? Now it's about creating opportunity for all and creating equitable access to education. A lot of the kids that we are providing services to, a ride can be life-changing. A ride can be the difference between continuing in a process to get a scholarship because they're able to get to the interview versus not being in the running for a scholarship anymore. A ride means I'm getting to school on time and I'm not spending 2 hours in public transit to get to school. I'm getting to school in 20 minutes so I can actually stay after for tutoring and get credit recovery because I've had to switch schools. So, I mean, we have seen outcomes where we are literally helping students graduate, increasing graduation rates, increasing learning outcomes, increasing attendance. We have a crisis in chronic absenteeism in this country right now. The White House has put out bulletins about it. One of the biggest factors in attendance is having a way to get there. And so that's what we are helping schools do. And we have shown that when schools use services like ours, whether you're using Hop, Skip, Drive, we're able to increase attendance rates, and particularly for these kids, which is so important and is literally giving them the opportunity to show up for school every day.
And at a time where we're falling behind, right, whether it's COVID-driven falling behind, the access to education, some of the other things we're seeing even on a macro political level, you need things like this. You need things like this for the country. You need things like this for our kids to succeed. And Hop, Skip, Drive is really filling a gap to really bring back access, information, and education to a large part of Americans.
Yeah, so when I think back to kind of 2020, a lot of public schools were shut, right? And I'm sure that was a pretty trying period for you. And so talk us through a little bit about what you thought at the time was the future of the company and the direction. I'm sure you made some really important moves then that kind of helped set the stage, because it seems like you're at the forefront of some transitions that were going to happen in transportation. At the time, I just remember as a public markets investor looking at like some of these gig economy stocks in the they were literally looked like there was no low enough for them, right? But then right now, we're like 3 years on the other side of this, and Uber has $170 billion market cap. It's trading at all-time high. You know what I mean?
But imagine if Uber at the time really had most of the rides going to or from school.
Yeah.
I'll let you tell the story about the board meeting we had in the beginning of March in 2020.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a board meeting right March 4th, and somebody asked, what is your plan for coronavirus? I said, plan? We don't need a plan. Public schools are not going to shut down. Just in case, yeah, maybe we should have a little bit of a safety strategy. We did actually move very quickly, and we saw it, right? We saw some of our customers, Seattle Public Schools, went on a 6-week break. LAUSD said we're taking a 3-week extended spring break. And that was even before 2 weeks to flatten the curve. But I could do the math pretty quickly and see what the revenue hit was going to be. We thought it was going to be a couple of weeks, but still that was pretty impactful. And so we made some pretty hard decisions very early. We actually did a small layoff March 13th, right before the world shut down. And we said, bring your laptops home because we may or may not be here on Monday. And then we never saw everyone ever again. But we did that because I had seen in my banking experience, the companies that reacted quickly to 9/11, to the financial crisis, those were the ones that made it through. And so at that point, we knew we had to do something. We did a small round then. We started having weekly board meetings, and it became clear very quickly that school was not coming back, right? But we thought it was coming back in August. So we spent a lot of time preparing for that. We knew schools were going to need it and kind of making sure that we were ready. It became very clear that schools were not going to come back in August of 2020. That was a particularly challenging time for the business. We got by the skin of our teeth. We had to do some pretty drastic things and had to do a very large layoff in August of 2020. I'm very proud to say that we hired a third of those people back. And the fact that they wanted to come back afterwards, I think, is a real testament to our culture and the kind of team that we've built. It wasn't a if, it was a when. We just didn't know when. So we did everything that we could to survive until that when. And we started thinking then about the challenges that schools were going to have. We knew that the drivers were gone. There'd been a shortage for over a decade, but half the drivers left during COVID. We knew that all of these kids had disappeared out of the system. We knew that the populations that we drive were only increasing. We've seen more kids on IEPs because of COVID-related issues. The homeless population has increased. There was, very sadly, a huge backlog of kids who should have been maybe removed from their homes but weren't in COVID because nobody knew what was going on. So all these populations increased. Schools were in crisis mode. And we saw those trends. And so we spent the time building for when schools were coming back. And that's when we really started thinking about what we are building now, which is our strategic routing software.
And even going back and to give Joanna the credit she deserves for the grit that was shown at that point, we had everything had been going well at the company. We were growing. We were setting new records. Things were great at that March 4th, 2020 board meeting. We thought we were magically fully financed, which is always a great day. Having having been an entrepreneur, it's gone through that of being fully financed, not worrying about everything. And then in the second quarter, we missed revenue by 98%. So basically, everything shut down. We were doing largely at the time school transportation for California. I think that was majority of our revenue, which as a state, shut down the quickest and the hardest and for the longest as possible. Yeah. We were investors in Airbnb and they saw obviously an effect from COVID, but I don't think I've heard of a business which has seen more of an effect from COVID and had been that jarring to doing it and to be able to go from all those phases of entrepreneurship from founding from zero, starting at a founder's table, mapping out the product to launching, scaling, diversifying revenue to then having the whole thing fall apart, literally fall apart and wondering, going from being fully financed and 45 days later, wondering if you have to shut the doors to your office and no one's ever coming back, to showing the path forward, even in light of when there weren't many green shoots over 2020 and 2021 and school closures continued, to being able to have an optimistic tenor to her board, to her team of saying, hey, we're going to get through this. And all the mega trends continue to be at our back. And being able to take that, communicate that, build trust, being able to pull together two financings at a time where there was very little revenue and very little certainty in the world, to be able to get the company back fully financed, and then coming out of it, setting up the team, the operations, and going forward. So as the world reopened up, jumping back into high growth mode, growing the business 100% for several years, and now on a path to be a market leader. Very rarely do you see a founder, CEO, entrepreneur able to deal with all of those pieces, which require very different skill sets, so capably.
You just mentioned the strategic routing system. So was this something that was really born during the crisis here? And again, this is not something that school districts would have built for themselves. This is not something you created a tool that you were pretty certain based on the trends and basically the founding purpose of the company that if you build it, they may come for all intents and purposes. So talk to me like what this technology means to these school districts and is it like an aha moment for them when they're thinking about their own needs as it relates to busing and their shortages of drivers and the like here, because I have to assume, much like many industries, I mean, what you just described went on in the airline industry, went on in a lot of industries, but backed by a proper technology and basically, obviously, a need for these sorts of services, like you could probably articulate why this could actually help solve a lot of problems for school districts.
We looked at the landscape. We looked at the trends. We also looked at, we are solving this problem for these discrete populations, but we're not solving the school transportation problem. How do we solve the school transportation problem? And that's really where that software came from. And so what the software does is, rather than most routing software for schools says, okay, you have 100 buses, let's route those buses. Our software is AI-backed and it looks at each student. So we're using AI to look at each student and determine what is the right vehicle, the right stop, the right route for this student. Is it a bus? Is it a sedan? Is it something else? And then how does that fit into the whole? And how do we customize this to solve the particular constraints of your district? Is that drivers? If it's bus drivers, we can solve for that. If it's cost, we can solve for that. If it's time in transit, we can solve for that. If it's emission, we can solve for that. And so the model is very flexible and very customizable to each district to optimize for what they need. And we've seen really great results. We have a district that we worked with in Colorado Springs. It was a topic at every board meeting. Everybody was upset. No one was getting to school. Buses were late. We came in. We used our software. They had 68 bus drivers. The next school year, they had 60 bus drivers. So they lost another 8. But now they have, with our software, 55 routes. We put a whole bunch of those kids on sedans, moved the bus drivers to the routes they needed to be on. So on-time arrival went from 80% to 95%. That gave them 17,000 hours of class time back. Their driver shortage was gone. We were able to keep it operating budget neutral, because they used the savings to pay the existing bus drivers more. So we were able to get an increase for bus drivers. And we were able to save them millions of dollars in CapEx because they realized they don't need as many buses as they have. They don't need to continue to purchase buses into the future. So it was ROI positive for the district, for bus drivers, for the community. We were also bringing a whole bunch of care drivers from the community to solve this problem, and obviously for the kids. And it was just a win all around. And we're replicating that now in lots of districts.
Let's talk about that replication. So are there some states, are there some demographics, is there regulatory environments that work really well? And then obviously I saw this case study, I think that you're talking about here in Colorado. It was a great piece in Axios. So yes. In the spirit of short brevity, it really did the job of driving home how this works and those efficiencies work. So I assume that when you're able to prove this to a school board, to the actual end users, and keep it within that budget neutral, as you described, it's probably a pretty easy sell. So how do you guys go out there and replicate this again and again and again?
We're just talking to the districts and talking to people. And I love that Axios piece. I love what they wrote at the end when they were talking about AI. And they said, this is a real case of AI actually solving some shortages rather than everybody thinks AI is going to come in and replace all these workers. And this is actually a case of AI addressing a shortage and finding solutions for it.
Yeah, we'll put this story in the show notes because it's actually really instructive. Rick, how do you think about that? Because again, this is a company you've been close to for a long time. And we talk about it on our podcast a lot because right now it's a really easy thing to talk about artificial intelligence and really talk about what are some of the commercialization of these sorts of products. But this is something that you built your tech platform on this sort of technology. Rick, how do you think about this? Because again, there's going to be some Johnny come latelys, you know what I mean, who are just dropping that. We all live through the .com thing, but this is actually like a pillar of the platform
it's a real true use of AI. It's a big data problem with people and routes and 100 million houses in the U.S. and how are people getting to the right place at the right time with the right route? That's a clear big data AI problem and a pure use of AI that Hopskip Drives would work on for years before it was the cool thing to do. Yeah, everybody's spraying the AI pixie dust all over everything now and trying to increase their valuation because of it. Like a lot of the other companies, including the ones that you've talked to, Dan, that these are companies who understand AI, understand how it could create value, and really using it to do something that's never been done before, and therefore doing real jobs and solving real problems.
One of the other ways that we've used AI and we use technology is on the safety side. From the very beginning, this was about what would it take for me to put Jackson or Sam in a hop, skip, drive? And that's how I built everything. And that's the experience, who care drivers are, but also all of our proprietary tech around safety, our Safe Ride support team.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that. What does that mean in terms of being able to track drivers, being able to track braking and speeding and all the things that people have talked about being in Ubers all the time? It's clear it's not being used by everyone.
Our proprietary Safe Ride support and Safe Ride technology monitors every ride in real time. That means parents have full transparency. That means school districts have full transparency. We've also built a completely unique system to let us know, hey, is something happening that maybe shouldn't be happening, right? Is a car stopped for a certain period of time? Does it seem to be going in a different direction than maybe it should be? Is it late? Lateness can be a safety issue when you're talking about a 7-year-old who is alone somewhere. We have technology that can detect that and then communicate with everybody to let everybody know what's going on. If needed, we can find another driver. Like, we've actually built technology to say this amount of lateness is going to be okay, but this amount is not, and now we need to find a new driver. And we have telematics in the vehicle that is detecting behavior in real time. We can tell if a driver's using their phone, speeding, swerving, and all of that goes into how we think about safety and how we use data to continually innovate on safety. And we publish a safety report every year. We're the only ones in the student transportation space that do that because we're proud of our record. We want to be transparent and we want to be accountable. It goes back to the trust and safety. You're going to trust us if we're transparent.
This is a lot about people, right? You put a lot of technology into cars, but it's a lot about people. And it's who we trust our kids to spend time with. Talk a little bit about how your driver pool might be a little bit different than a normal Uber or Lyft.
So I said we call them care drivers because they're caregivers. They have to have 5 years of caregiving experience. So these are parents, these are grandparents, these are retired school teachers. They're driving very part-time looking for supplemental work. And they call this, many of them have called this the best paid volunteer opportunity that they've ever had. And so what's unique about the platform is we're really creating this brand new source of supply in a very supply constrained market and a source of supply that could never contract directly with the schools, right? Susie, who's the retired teacher, could never go into a school and say, I'm going to contract with you to drive for you. But through our platform, she has access to this.
And
it's really a give back.
Background screen, drug screens, fingerprinted for all those things. And then you wrap it in technology. But then for that new supply that you're bringing on, the Susies of the world, you're giving them a completely different job than driving for an Uber.
That's right.
As you think about all this three-sided marketplace or even a four-sided marketplace, depending on all these different people that are part of your network, that supply is completely different.
It's completely different. It's unique. And they're coming to us because we're unique, right? Mm-hmm. They want an experience that is safe for them. They want to be able to see all of the rides available to them and choose which ones work for them. And because there's a very recurring nature to these rides, it's to and from school for an entire school year, they can choose to do the same rides for a long period of time. So they can truly set a very recurring, predictable schedule in a way that fits in and around their lives.
And I guess that makes that all these rides are sometimes recurring. You have the flexibility if there's a one-off, whether it's spring break or a baseball team rain out. But at the same time, you have visibility, especially at scale, knowing that there's you wake up in the morning knowing there's going to be 10,000 rides tomorrow.
That's right. We have pretty full visibility for the entire school year.
Let's talk about like where you're going away from, let's just say, some of these like core. It seems like you could stay focused on this one market. But like when you think about my dad for years, who's now elderly, he's 82, so I can call him elderly, I guess. I don't think he'd be offended by that. He drove Meals on Wheels, delivering meals to elderly people. I'm at a point where like I'd kind of like my parents to actually have a pretty good Uber situation. I don't really want them driving. Are these areas that you're thinking about here? And I'm sure they're pretty similar to, you know what I mean? You could set some similar sort of parameters as you do for the recurring nature of school.
We think about growth in a lot of ways. The way I think about our platform is really great to provide mobility services for anyone who needs a little extra care. Where care and safety are a part of the equation, that's where we shine.
So hospitals, I mean, they could go on and on.
Where I think growth comes from for the next many years to come, it's continuing to grow share of wallet with our existing districts. Our net revenue retention is off the charts, and we grow very nicely within them with negligible, like no churn, right? So continuing to grow with our existing school district clients, expanding to new markets, and then thinking about, like I said, I want to solve school transportation. So there's the $30 billion that schools are providing transportation, and that's a massive market. 50% of our kids still take a personal vehicle to school. It's kind of where we started. And so I think there's a big opportunity there in a massive way that is a huge untapped market. And then I think older adults is also a huge untapped market.
Rick, when you think about a $30 billion, you know, do you want to call it a TAM?
No, $30 billion is a huge TAM. So you think about just getting kids to and from school. But we all know that have kids, school is only a piece of the puzzle. Everything your kids need to do and where they need to go and how that needs to happen. Plus, as we've alluded to, all the government programs who make sure the most that need transportation needs of kids who are homeless, kids who are foster kids, ways that we're increasing accessibility to education, which is so important to our country. And then adjacent markets, knowing that we have a very discreet, highly regulated, highly motivated supplier base of drivers. And those care drivers are a competitive advantage for us. The network a competitive advantage for us, and therefore no different than you would only trust your kids in certain cars, you'd only trust your parents in certain cars, and you think about everybody else who might just need a little bit more help, and we're there to provide that for them.
Do you want to talk to us a little, and I'm not trying to get you in a Travis Kalanick moment here, but remember 10 years ago, probably when you were starting this company, he was on stage somewhere, and he said, yeah, the real problem with our business model is the drivers, you know what I mean? And ironically, he was probably 15 years too early on that, so when you think about full self-driving, driving, and you think about robo-taxis, and we've heard it again and again. Yeah. Rick, how many pitches have you had probably on your desk over the last 15 years or so? But someday it's going to happen. And someday it'll be probably a really important part of your business if you think about it. I'm just sure, are you tracking those trends closely? Is it interesting to you? Is it something that kind of fits within this trust and safety narrative? I know that once they're introduced, it's going to take years and years for parents to feel comfortable about doing that. But it's going to happen sooner or later. I'm just curious what like some of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I look at it. I think that school transportation is probably going to be one of the last adopters of it. But when I think about the beauty of our care driver network, they're caregivers. So the driving is one part of it, but they're also providing care while they're in the car. I'm not building autonomous capabilities. Somebody else can build that tech. But in the world where it is all autonomous, that's great. You still need a caregiver with that child. And now maybe they can tutor the child on the way, right? So I think the need for our marketplace and what we've built will evolve. Like I said, it's mobility where safety and care are a big part of it. And so even with autonomous, there's a need for that. I mean, in your example of older adults, right? The autonomous vehicle isn't going to walk your dad into the doctor's office.
Dan, as you were saying, obviously we're growing the TAM of the market, not only schools, but also all the activities for kids, not only school districts, but also all of the Department of Ed initiatives on a federal level where we have long-term grants, and also looking at the senior market. Besides the mission, Joanna, besides this huge market, talk a little bit about how the business works today.
The way the business works today, we're operating in a massive space. It's contracted revenue. It is reoccurring revenue. So it really looks SaaS-like with margins that are more than 2x what a typical rideshare margin looks like. So we're a marketplace business, but operating in an enterprise space that's really more B2G because all of our customers are government contracts. So those are recurring big dollars. And this is critical, right? This is kids have to get to school.
And I guess those are big wallets that you're growing every year as you get deeper into the state of California or even the state of Los Angeles, city of Seattle, state of Colorado.
That's right. Yes, the contracts continue to grow. We continue to grow share of wallet. The wallets are really big. And our share of those wallets continues to grow and grow in a way that has really favorable unit economics to create a very profitable business.
All right. So you mentioned NDR, the net dollar retention. It sounds like you didn't put any numbers on it, but again, you said you're a SaaS-like model. And we were talking about this a bit earlier. Like some of these sort of, if you want to call them rideshare companies, in the years after they went public, they were unprofitable, right? The public markets appreciated them for like just like a couple weeks, it felt. And then obviously COVID was a difficult time. But talk to us. Because again, you have a lot of the really interesting dynamics about the growth of those markets, but your business model looks really different, especially with the margin structure you have and the NDR. So talk to us a little bit about that.
When we contract with a school district, once it's all about trust, right? Once they trust the service, they continue to add riders and they continue to add use cases. And so our net revenue retention at some of our customers is 3x year over year, right? On average, it's 2x what best in class SaaS looks like. So we continue to, we could stop selling tomorrow and continue to double or triple the business just with existing clients. And we see that every year. We just continue to grow, go up. They give us more. They give us more. And that's frankly, the strategic routing software also helps that because it optimizes their whole system, which typically means we should be putting more kids into sedans. And so that just continues to grow our share of wallet.
And that's the whole network effect part of the business. And as you build that great network effect business like this, it is more sustainable as you grow and more profitable as you grow. And even as we talked about all the ups and downs in the roller coaster ride that Joanna went through, the fact that she's profitable as well as growing over 100% a year means that despite being affected by COVID, she's exactly where you'd want to be, not there soon thereafter, of growing 100% and not at an Uber scale and where they need to be to get to a dollar of EBITDA profitability. These guys are profitable at a much lower scale because it's just a much better business.
Yeah, we haven't been talking about too many companies in the private tech market that have been profitable and have that sort of growth profile. And the other thing is, it's really interesting to me is like when I just think about through the lens that I look at, we've had these waves of different tech excitement, right? Some was the, a lot of the consumer facing marketplace apps or this and that, or whatever. And then we got into some kind of SaaS and then some cloud. And now it seems to be generative AI. It seems like your company has components of all of the best attributes of those different waves. And so to me, it's really interesting, Rick. I know you've been talking about Joanna and her mission with Hop Skip Drive. So it's really been a great pleasure to get to know you and hear about the company. So I really appreciate you being here. And Rick, of course, always the mic
always
is here
great.
For you, man. So I appreciate it, Joanna. Thanks
Thank
so much.
Thank you so much.
If you like what you heard, make sure to hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com.